This is The Wildlife.
I'm Richard.
I'm Devin. Stick around.
Probably not, though. I'm more inclined.
What you're hearing right now is a debate Richard and I have been having for years.
Sure, they'll probably find some.
And I'm totally right in that debate.
Doesn't necessarily. And it's about
aliens.
Now, before you think what I think you're thinking, which is why are we talking about aliens on a natural history and biodiversity podcast? The answer is, well, I mean, technically speaking, if something is alive on another planet, that would be the wildlife of that planet, which would be the natural history and biodiversity of that planet, right? And so it works. It connects. And to Richard's credit, he makes some compelling arguments, like this one.
Yeah, I just think if you just look at the numbers, really, that, yeah, there's a lot of more science to it than that, but it's just, it really goes beyond, like, the scope of comprehension with how vast the universe is. And, like, have you ever seen, like, a video or anything that really talks about, like, the true difference between, like, a million and a billion? Or just, like, how many combinations of cards you can actually make with a deck? Or just anything like that to really help, like, wrap your mind around how larger numbers actually are?
Yeah.
And, having looked into things like that, it's just, you see the numbers, and I mean, I can't even count that high. Like, I didn't understand what these numbers meant until I looked them up. Because, say, like, with the amount of stars, there's estimated a septillion stars in the observable universe. Like, do you know how high a septillion is?
Right.
I didn't know how high a septillion was until, like, 10 minutes ago. But it's one followed by 24 zeros.
That's a lot of zeros.
So that's a lot of stars. And they talk about that, like, on average, a star usually has 1.6 planets around it.
Okay. Yes. And, like, there's the whole, you know, if 99% of the people in the world don't find you attractive, then that still means that 76 million people do.
Yeah, I actually just saw that today.
Basically, Devin is closed-minded and doesn't think complex alien life is out there.
No, see, what I'm saying is not that it's impossible, but just improbable. And I'm not just pulling that out of thin air. I'm basing that on the fact that the same could be said about what happened on the only planet that we know for certain has complex life. Earth.
Yeah, I'm telling the same eyes with you, but I may be wrong too.
Great, you brought backup. Who's this?
This is Dr. Nick Lane. He's a biochemist and professor at the University College of London, not to mention a writer, particularly of the book that inspired me to reach out to him in the first place. It's called The Vital Question, Why is Life the Way It Is?
Bit of a broad question.
Well, I mean, yeah, any question about such a multifaceted topic is gonna be, right? But it's precisely the right question to be asking when thinking about things like life on other planets.
So where do we begin?
Where else but the beginning?
Nice.
So the origin of life, well...
So here's the thing about the origin of life in general. It's complicated, and as far as we know, it happened once a very long time ago, and...
We don't know, and we probably never will know.
Ever. I mean, there are people out there right now trying to pinpoint this and replicate certain conditions and things, but it's not like we can hop in the TARDIS and go back to the beginning and see for ourselves.
But what we can try and do as scientists is try and understand the principles that might give rise to life, and in that sense, it applies to Earth, but it would apply to other places as well.
Problem is?
I would say there's very little agreement in the field about what those principles are, because the question is kind of a really extended question.
After all, this really isn't one question with one answer.
It's a whole series of things, from the very first chemistry that gives rise to organic molecules, right the way through to the self-organization of molecular machines inside cells, which are amazingly complex entities.
Well, we've got to be able to start somewhere, and clearly y'all did, so where do we begin?
LOL, begin. Richard, think back to middle school. Do you remember the main characteristics of life?
Yeah, it's like reproduction and response to stimuli and all, yeah.
To me, I guess the key thing about the origin of life, and this is, it sounds almost silly, because after years and years of thinking about it and wrestling with these questions, I think it comes down to the word growth.
Yeah, growth.
Growth. See, without growth, many of those things are irrelevant or wouldn't occur in the first place.
You need to have an environment which is not just making organic molecules, but is kind of making them continually...
Much like us. I mean, we're constantly breathing.
Burning organic molecules to provide the energy that we need, not just to move around and not just to think, but to repair all the bits and pieces of cells, to make new cells and so on.
Makes sense. Like the analogy, by the way.
And when you have that, when you have growth, you've got reproduction. You don't have genetic heredity yet, but it would, I think, arise in that kind of an environment.
Check.
What do you mean?
Well, let him talk a bit more and I think you'll see.
So what kind of environments would drive growth? Well, they're the environments that are kind of continuously active. Things like hydrothermal vents, where you have a continual flow of reactive fluids going into the early oceans. That's the kind of setting that will lead to a continuous reactivity.
Ready to explain yet?
Hold on.
Okay, well, the first kind of cells, something like bacteria...
They're tiny things that you can't see except with a microscope.
They were still complex.
To get that level of complexity, even in cells, requires natural selection. And to get selection requires growth and copying of some sort. And that requires an environment which is going to just be continuously feeding growth. And that requires effectively a planet that... is geologically active, which is continually feeding growth as a whole planet. And it turns out that quite a few planets do exactly that. Not just planets, Mars probably was like that, but currently in the solar system, places like Enceladus.
Boom. Enceladus. Just one of the moons of Saturn theorized to possibly harbor life, and it isn't even in the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, but bacterial life. You see, that's precisely my point.
That hardly matters, though, because... The way I see it, even if there's one other planet with bacterial life just in the solar system, out of all the billions of planets and star systems that exist, that, I think, drives the possibility of complex life up by a long shot.
Well, remember, I'm not completely writing off the idea that something more complex can exist. I'm merely saying that it isn't as likely or it's improbable. And to understand what I mean, you have to understand what happened on Earth itself was very improbable.
Very early on, we see signs of bacteria, fossils that look a lot like bacteria from close on 4 billion years ago. And then we see effectively no change. We can see in the rocks that there was a lot of evolution, that metabolic pathways evolved, things like photosynthesis, so using the sun to split water and steal the hydrogen from water and make organics from that. That happened maybe 3 billion years ago, between 2 and 3 billion years ago. But still, the cells that were doing it are bacteria. They're very simple, very small cells, the kind of thing that if you find on another planet, you're going to, hey, there's life here, but it's not kind of sophisticated aliens that are going to cross-examine you. So it's an interesting long, long gap from the origin of life on Earth to the first really complex cells, the kind of cells like our own cells or like plant cells or algae that you see in the oceans today as seaweed. It was 2 to 3 billion years for this more complex cell type to arise. And it, so, you know, it begs the question, why did it take so long? Was it genuinely improbable?
Let's call this section improbability one. Richard, did you hear that? 2 to 3 billion years for something as simple as algae to arise.
Here are some other numbers. We've also had 5 mass extinctions where virtually all life on the land or sea went extinct. Just imagine a planet older than ours where perhaps these extinction events didn't occur. No meteor 65 million years ago.
And don't ruin our finale. You know what? Just listen for a moment. Life in the beginning.
Well, we can only really be guided by modern-day bacteria. We assume that they were cells in that sense, that they probably had a membrane. We don't really know what that membrane was made of. It could have been a very simple one, just made from components of our own membranes, things like fatty acids, which will form a similar kind of membrane, but a simpler one.
Maybe a cell wall, we don't really know.
The very first cells, almost certainly, the cells that we can reconstruct have DNA and RNA. The very first ones probably didn't, but we don't really know what the course was to go from just organics to that kind of heredity. So the first cells that would have escaped from vents and lived free lifestyle in the oceans would certainly have had DNA. They certainly would have been cell-like structures. They could keep the inside different from the outside, so they had membrane pumps and so on.
But from the first stirring of chemistry to complex cells, that gap in time was tremendous. And there are two ways to look at it.
One of them is... What we can do is compare the genes that we have and the cell structures that we have with all other complex life on Earth. And that would mean plants, other animals, fungi, mushrooms, and so on, algae, seaweeds, but also single-celled organisms like amoeba and all kinds of protozoans that live in ponds and the oceans and so on. And there's one really striking thing that you see from all of that, which is in our basic structure at the level of cells, we are almost identical.
Like we're all of the same brand or bought from the same store. We all have the same basic components.
So we all have a nucleus where we keep the DNA. We all have the same kind of protein structures that make up the pores in the membrane around the nucleus. We all have mitochondria, the powerhouses of cells. We all have quite complicated internal membrane systems that form the machinery of cells. And we see exactly the same thing in plant cells and animal cells. So the conclusion from all of that is we certainly have a common ancestor that was a complex cell.
Pretty much like one of our own cells.
And the disturbing point is that bacteria don't really have any of that complex machinery. They have it at the level of proteins, but not at the level of whole cells. They're just lacking that, really. And there are no intermediates that we know about. We've never found them.
Not that they never existed. We've just never found them.
So you could say, well, yeah, there was a process that gives rise to complex life and it just happened to take over the world once, but there could have been thousands of occasions where it happened. And that might be true. But there's no evidence that that was the case. The only evidence that we have is that it happened once.
Improbability number two.
So then you can turn it around on its head and say, okay, well, could it have happened thousands or millions of times? In which case it will be probable and what we're faced with is just the one case that did especially well and wiped everything else out. It seems reasonable and...
not likely.
The thing is that bacteria, there's two groups of cells that are like bacteria. There's the bacteria themselves and then there's another group that look basically the same and they're called archaea. They're called archaea because they were thought to be even more ancient than bacteria, but it turns out that they're probably just a kind of sister group. Mm-hmm. And the genetic variation that you see in these two groups is immense.
They virtually scoured sequence space and explored evolutionary possibility, and neither have come up with anything that looks remotely complex like a eukaryotic cell.
So they've kind of explored all of this evolutionary space, but it's been metabolic space, not morphological space. It's got nothing to do with complex, large plants, cells, and animals. They never gave rise to that. And that makes it genuinely look improbable, that there's something, not genetic, not about information, there's something which is stopping bacteria becoming complex, which is probably to do with their structure rather than to do with the genes.
So what y'all are saying is there seems to be some sort of structural difference that accounts for why life finds it so hard to grow from simple to complex.
Not just that, but that the growth isn't so much a progression as it is a leap. And yes, structure, but more accurately, well, let me ask you this. At its very core, what is life? I mean, when I wake up and I eat breakfast and exercise and breathe and exist and all these things, what is it ultimately tied to?
Energy.
Exactly.
There isn't a general agreement about this, but energy does seem to be the difference.
And cellularly, do you know where we get our energy?
The powerhouse of the cell. Mitochondria.
And we get our energy from our mitochondria. So these were bacteria once, free-living bacteria, that gained entrance to our type of cell, same kind of cell that plants have as well. And they effectively, they are self-contained power packs.
Wait, what?
Cells are really big on engulfing, and well, we'll get there, but first...
The way that energy works in cells is not how anybody would ever have guessed. Effectively, we're electrically charged.
Like Frankenstein.
It's alive!
If you were to shrink yourself down to the size of a molecule and put yourself in the electric field right next to the membrane, the charge that you would experience is in the order of 30 million volts per meter. The thing is that you're dealing with distances that are a billionth of a meter. In distance.
That's the equivalent to a bolt of lightning.
A bolt of lightning.
Dang, okay. I mean, I knew there was, like, electrical currents going on organically, but to think that that's what it's equivalent to really puts it into a new perspective.
And it seems to require genes to kind of regulate that charge, to make sure that it doesn't, you know, burn itself out.
It just so happens that...
And the mitochondria have their own genes, and they always have genes. A little, so they're power packs that come with their own genetic control unit. And what that means is that if you want to become bigger and more energetic, if you like, what you need is more of these units, more mitochondria. And it's relatively easy to scale because each one is its kind of genetically controlled power pack, and you just have more power packs.
If you want to bulk up, you need more food. And what is food but energy?
Okay, but who's to say this didn't happen elsewhere also?
That's our next improbability. Remember how you wanted to know how mitochondria got into our cells and all eukaryotes?
Going back 2 billion years, some of these bacteria got inside other cells. Now, that in itself is pretty improbable if we're talking about bacteria. We're talking about bacterial cells getting inside other bacterial cells. And, you know, they're small and they've got a cell wall, and it doesn't happen very often. We do know of a couple of examples of it, really only one good example of it.
Well, cells are big on engulfing, like I said, but it's rare to get cells in another cell. Once they're there, chances are it's all going to go horribly wrong. I mean, think about it.
Yeah, doesn't sound like a good mix.
You're going to have to kind of synchronize life cycles, and one can't outgrow the other one.
Or else?
Go bluey.
Or turns into a kind of a parasite or a pathogen or something, and then it's likely to go wrong. Or if it grows too slowly, then it just gets lost again very easily. If we're talking about a singular origin of complex life, and it's something that disturbs most scientists because, you know, we scientists deal in statistics, in probability, in repeatability, and then a singular event is something which, you know, most people back away from and say that's not science, that's more like a miracle. But there is a way of looking at it which is not like a miracle. It says, okay, let's take this as the starting point. Let's say that we've got bacteria inside these other bacterial cells. Well, what do you think would happen next? Well, one thing you might expect would happen is that there would be kind of war games going on.
An evolutionary arms race.
So instead of kind of thinking it's a weird singular event, you're saying, okay, well, maybe the reason that eukaryotes are so complex is because there was this kind of conflict going on between two types of cell which are living in really intimate conditions with each other, inside each other. The chances of it going wrong must be really high, but also the chances of it promoting a kind of Red Queen type effect where you sure. just stay still and you get more and more complex just to kind of remain where you are. You know, the sheer complexity of eukaryotic cells, these complex cells that make us up, does smell a little bit of a kind of runaway competition.
That is just fascinating.
Coevolution happens on every scale, and who's to say it doesn't happen all the way down? Now, this isn't an Adam and Eve single joining type thing. This happened probably with a lot of different cells, but one particular point in time. That's what we mean here by a one-time occurrence. But what this ultimately comes down to are rules. There really are no rules for life. There's no rule that says life has to get bigger. There's no rule that says life has to get more complex. There's no rule that says it has to be structured a certain way, or that it has to be based in a certain thing, or has to look a certain way. There are simply no rules.
The question is, I suppose, do these principles that happen to apply to life on Earth, would they apply to life on other planets? Is it something which we can generalize from, or is it something which is just a historical chance that it happened this way here and somewhere else? If you had a different structure to life, maybe it would follow a different path. I mean, again, we don't know the answer, but that boils down to questions like, for example, would life elsewhere be cellular? Would it be composed sure. the same kind of building block, and more importantly, would there be a requirement for an electrical charge on membranes and genes to control that electrical charge? Because that's essentially why bacteria have remained small and simple, and how our own complex eukaryotic cells escaped from that loop by this singular event that changed the direction of evolution for our ancestors. And I think there are good grounds to say, yes, life is fundamentally electrical, and you really would find that it was cellular on other planets and that those cell membranes surrounding it would have a similar kind of electrical charge. It boils down to what are the requirements for life starting in the first place. And on Earth, it's really about hydrogen and carbon dioxide. Those are the two things that you need and all life uses to make organic molecules and grow. And hydrogen comes bubbling out of the ground in the kind of hydrothermal vents that I was talking about earlier on. And carbon dioxide, you can think of it as a Lego brick that's there in the atmosphere, it's dissolved in the oceans. You just need to effectively cobble some hydrogen onto this carbon dioxide and you've got your organic molecules. The trouble is they don't react. If we could make CO2 react with hydrogen, we can strip CO2 out of the atmosphere, no more problem with global warming and so on. And no more problem with energy security. We can make synthetic gasoline. Right? So it would be great if we could do that. And to my knowledge, maybe someone's sitting on it in some company somewhere to unveil it when the right time comes, but it's basically a difficult thing to do economically. But cells do it all the time. And the way that they do it is by this electrical charge on the membrane. That's how they're operating. What that charge is doing is effectively forcing CO2 to react with hydrogen. That's the bottom line on it all. So I suspect that will be true on other planets as well. The processes that give rise to the kind of vents that are producing hydrogen should be really common. There's a good argument to say there would be tens of billions of planets in the Milky Way or moons in the Milky Way that have similar processes. It's basically the same kind of geology that you would see. We see it on Mars, we see it on Enceladus, it's common. But it provides an opportunity and it provides a constraint. And I think then if you're thinking in terms of statistical probability, the likelihood is that the same constraints are going to apply to life elsewhere as well. It's probably going to be carbon-based, it's probably going to be cellular, it's probably going to have this electrical charge, and then it's probably going to face the same constraints which delayed the origin of complex life on Earth by 3 billion years, and it only happened once. So it looks like it might well be improbable to find complex life elsewhere too for the same reasons.
Lane in his book says, "We are eukaryotes and it offends our dignity to see ourselves as Johnny-come-lately genetic mongrels. I like to think of it as a spin on the term anthropocentric, but eukaryocentric. It's hard for us to imagine that not only that maybe humans aren't the apex of evolution, but that eukaryotes, while multicellular organisms, might also not be. I mean, again, there are no rules. We're kind of making them up as we go along here on Earth. So who's to say that life elsewhere needs to be complex, or needs to be multicellular, or needs to look anything like it does here on Earth? That's sort of the theme for the season, actually. It's kind of a putting people in their place as far as being the apex of evolution and things. We're going to be talking about different abilities, superpowers, if you will, that exist elsewhere in the animal kingdom that humans can't even imagine or put to words, or the fact that other animals throughout the animal kingdom do things that we think that humans are the only ones to do. Yeah, the whole thing is really about putting you in your place.
It's kind of a little difficult sometimes to disentangle that from a sense of our own importance, a sense of our destiny, that somehow, regardless even if there's a God or not, but there's some destiny that if God's created everything, then sure, that, you know, he's set in motion some process that was bound to give rise to us in the end. If it wasn't God, then there's something about the laws of the universe that provides a destiny which is going to lead to us in the end. And it's basically navel-gazing, you know, we're self-important, conceited, and we like to think that we are the end point of evolution, which of course is not remotely true. And if you look at it from a kind of broader point of view, then even an end point of plants and animals seems quite improbable. It's perfectly easy to imagine that most planets would just have bacteria or nothing at all. But, you know, bacteria don't seem such a problem. And it seems to me that it's perfectly easy for planets to be stable bacterial ecosystems that go on doing what they did for billions of years without ever giving rise to the kind of complexity that we love on Earth.
But doesn't this all make you feel lonely?
In some ways, yeah. But ultimately, I think, really, it makes me appreciate life on Earth all the more. I mean, if you just take a moment to think, we are improbable. The fact that we exist, you and I talking right now on a podcast, 1,200 miles away from each other, never mind. The fact that that's even happening right now, the fact that we have blue whales and mushrooms and rose bushes and caterpillars undergoing metamorphosis, the fact that all of these things are happening, as improbable as they are, almost makes me appreciate life here so much more, and the complexity that we see around us so much more.
It is all the more special, I agree with you. And it would be a tragedy to screw it all up, wouldn't it? I think the other thing that looking at life from this point of view, we really are a composite of cell types that have learned to live together in an intimate way. The fact that our mitochondria are derived from bacteria and that those bacteria go back to the very origin of life gives us a kind of an unbroken energy connection with the origin of life. It's not only about genes, it's also about the cell structures and the energy of this idea that we have electrically charged membranes, and that electrical charge goes back 4 billion years. The thing that's keeping you alive now is effectively an unbroken flame that goes back 4 billion years to the very origin of life on Earth and unites all life on Earth. It's not just the genes that unite us, it's this electrical charge on membranes that's uniting us as well. And it's a beautiful thought, and it gives us a kind of grounding in all of life that I find beautiful.
So, that being said, I might be wrong. So after all that, did your position change at all?
I don't think it can. I mean, maybe I just don't really understand it in the way that I should. And if I knew different things, it would change. But for now, it's too strong of a hope. And I just see a lot of it so differently. I hear the same thing. And I think of a way for it to be supportive of the argument. It's kind of just like people of two different political parties. Because say, like, we can both talk about how things make it more probable or more improbable. But the way I see it, you got to think of how little we honestly understand the universe at all beyond Earth. Because in the hundreds of thousands of years that humanity has been humanity, it's only been in the past few hundred years that we've even really began to see much of our own solar system. I mean, I was looking up all these different moons like Titan and Enceladus and Europa and stuff, trying to figure out things for my argument, and a lot of the discovery dates were like the 1600s, or like there's people who are still alive today when we first sent our very first satellites and probes into space. And like even to this day, the percentage of the universe we can observe with our most powerful sensors and telescopes compared to what's believed to be the real size of the universe is just, like, relatively nothing at all.
I guess that's it then, huh? I mean, our closure doesn't exactly really have any closure. We're just kind of where we were at the beginning.
I guess so.
You know what? That's different for us, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I like the different approach of more of a philosophical discussion of an episode rather than a dishing out the facts. Although we did still dish out plenty of facts, I think.
Yeah. Well, I guess there you have it, folks. But one more thing.
Yeah, there is one thing. A complex organism from Earth that at times could be considered an alien.
Sort of.
Sort of.
Hi guys, I'm a water bear.
Hey.
Hi. Oh, wait, I thought, what do you mean water bear though? I thought, or tardigrade, right?
Well, yeah, technically I'm a tardigrade, but I prefer water bear. See, some people call us moss piglets, but I find that one personally offensive.
Okay.
Plus, tardigrade literally means slow moving, and I'm not that slow, so whatever.
I mean, it took you 2 weeks to get to the studio, but... Sorry, you're small. Yes, okay. So, tell us a little bit about yourself. How long have tardigrades been around?
Well, we've been around way longer than you. Like 600 million years. We were kicking it 3.5 million years before dinosaurs even existed. We were around before flowers and even before the first animals crawled onto land.
Wow.
Dang.
I did not. Okay, that's... Okay. How big are you? I mean, not big. How small are you?
Well, I mean, considering you're using a scope to look at me, you should know we're smaller than a grain of sand and really only need a thin layer of water and dirt or leaf litter or whatever to rock and roll, but we can handle just about anything.
Okay. You know, I've heard a lot about your ability to exist and handle a lot of different environments, and you... What's your records?
Well, I think you're talking about temperature. We can handle temps as low as 450 degrees below zero and about 350 above. If there's no moisture, though, we can drop our metabolisms down to like 0.01% of our normal rate and go into cryptobiosis. You know what that is?
No. What is that?
Well, you should.
Okay, thank you.
It's suspended animation. Mr. Biologist coming at me.
I was trying to give you the opportunity to represent
Target. No.
Okay. Sorry.
Water bears.
Water bears, yes.
Okay. So, it's suspended animation. Our eggs can lay dormant for decades upon decades. We can even survive in space, which you can't.
Yeah, I've heard that. Space, like, really?
Yeah.
That, wait, but like, okay. Ricky, sorry, Richard. Space? Like, we're space, like, in space.
Aliens.
Well, no. Well, at least...
survive in space,
I mean,
man.
Technically, would that be complex alien life? Huh? I don't know, but okay. How, like, really, like, can you elaborate?
Well, at least for 10 days or so. It takes 100 times the radiation to kill us that it does you. Again, we're superior. So basically, long after humans are gone, we'll continue to reign supreme.
Okay. That's terrifying and fascinating and, yeah, a little harsh. I mean, supreme, I mean, okay.
Coming from a human.
True. That's valid, right? This season, did we not say this season is about putting people in their place, right? So thank you, Tardigrade. Yeah. Thank you, Water Bear, for coming in and putting us in our place and showing us just how amazing you are.
Thank you for having me.
Actually, hey, real quick, before we get to Animal Sound of the Week, just want to add one more thing, and that's thank you for bearing with us in this episode. We know at times it might have gotten a little complicated and a little deep and technical, but there was a lot of information, and Dr. Nicolene had a lot to share on a very broad and complicated topic with a lot of angles and things. So if you are interested, though, in one more pretty cool bonus fact about mitochondria and how many we have in our bodies and things like that, stay tuned at the very end of the episode for a bonus with Dr. Nick Lane.
And now it is time for
Animal Sound of the Week.
The Animal Sound of the Week!
Well, with the new season, it's time for new Animal Sounds of the Week. And this week, we've got a special sound. Well, I mean, it's an animal sound. And it's the one of the week. And anyway, here it is. Richard, you want to give it a go? Creepy.
I don't even... It makes a couple different sounds. I'm wondering which one I should try to replicate.
I know. That's where I'm kind of struggling here. I mean, I could do like the... that didn't work. What about that?
I don't know. I don't really know where to go with this one. I feel like I've said that for the past six episodes, though.
Well... That's the point. In all fairness, we're humans, we can do human sounds, but, you know.
Generally, if it's something that's hard to guess, it's going to be hard to replicate the noise.
Okay. How about this? On the count of three, we'll give it our, we'll do 1, 2, 3, animal sound, and we'll do our best go at it.
Okay.
1, 2, 3.
Ah! Oh! Yeah! Oh! Oh! Oh!
As always, send us your guesses on Facebook for a chance to win a prize.
Maybe not a great prize, but a prize nonetheless.
Remember, if you have questions for us that you want, nay, need answered, you can submit your questions by sending us a Facebook message at the Wildlife Blog. Or you can click our big green button that says Ask TWL on the front page of the website. There are no such thing as bad or dumb questions. The whole of human knowledge came to be only after millions and millions of wrong guesses, near misses, and failures. So never, ever be afraid to ask or try to guess based on what you've observed and already know for that matter, because that's how we learn. It's the scientific process.
Instructions on how to submit your questions can be found at thewildlife.blog/podcast.
The Wildlife is listener, reader, and viewer supported. And can be found on SoundCloud and iTunes.
If you believe in what we're doing, you can show your support by becoming a patron at patreon.com patreon.com/thewildlife. That's patreon.com/thewildlife.
When you become a patron, you'll gain exclusive access to content and have the opportunity to appear in our show to ask your questions or help read the credits.
For sources and a more in-depth look at what we've talked about today, check out thewildlife.blog. As always, if we've made a mistake or got something wrong, please let us know with a quick message and we'll do our best to correct our error.
Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our podcast in the iTunes store and share it with your friends.
How much mitochondria do we, as humans, how much of our bodies are mitochondria?
Well, it's close on 40%, I think. I mean, it's a little difficult to count, but we've got hundreds or thousands of them in all our cells. And they make up quite a large part of it. They make up the majority of our DNA as well. So we have a lot more in the nucleus, but we have many more mitochondria than we, you know, we have two copies of each of our genes in the nucleus of every cell. But we've got thousands of copies of the mitochondrial genome in every single cell. So we are, you know, large part bacterial.
That's just so cool. that's so neat.